This podcast is supported by Podcast Labs, Bournemouth's full-service podcast production and marketing agency.
Hello, welcome to the 10th Degree podcast. I'm Anthony Story. Now, law, that can be a heavy word. But if you've ever woken up in a cold sweat panicking about a contract obligation, you know it's important. Even if you get a headache, you need to think about this. So, Sean Guppy from Steel Raymond is a lawyer, and he's got corporate law covered. He talks about the most important legal points every entrepreneur needs to consider, from setting out to selling the company. And luckily, it's not all scary. Importantly, he's also got an opinion about the most relevant legal shows to watch on TV. So let's go. Oh, and if you haven't reviewed us yet, please do. We really appreciate it. Thanks. Here I am with Sean Guppy. Sean's a lawyer who works in the company and commercial team at Steel Raymond LLP. So you're interested in helping and advising different types of companies, from startups, sole traders, to much more established companies as well, particularly kind of private limited companies, maybe partnerships, maybe other LLPs as well. You've said that your goal is to give commercially sensible legal advice, but also support the companies that you work with in the development of their business. So I thought that's really interesting. Do you think that there's a change happening in professional firms where people are beginning to define themselves less by the specific practice that they can deliver and more by the value and the knowledge that they have?
Yeah, I think you can add more to a business has a life cycle, and people usually come to solicitors and other professional advisors because they have an idea as to what they want to achieve, but they don't necessarily know how to achieve it, or actually they just want the support in achieving it. And I think professional advisors need to have in their mind, there is a right and wrong way, specifically from a legal perspective, but actually what someone comes to you with is not always exactly what they want to do. And actually, I think it draws on our commercial experience as well from the clients that we've seen over a number of years as to exactly what advice we give them and where they are looking to go. But I think, yeah, you can add a little bit more if you've got that depth of experience and you can see where the decisions that people made historically through your past clients and actually pass those sort of little nuggets on to your future clients. I think that's where you can add more value, definitely.
How often do you find that people come to you with a clear idea of what they need? So will people come to you and present what they think is a legal problem, or will people come to you and just go, I've got a problem?
I think it's a concept usually, more that they know exactly what they want to achieve. They know where they're going, but be it actually, okay, fine. We've got existing shareholders here. We've got an investor who wants to, you know, inject funds into the company or the business. How do we go about doing that? And there's obviously a number of ways that you can do that. And it's presenting the options to people at that stage. So there's an end goal, but actually everything in between is probably a bit of a blur. They don't quite know how to get to that point. So yeah, no, I think that's what I find quite interesting, is seeing what different people want to achieve different things within their own businesses, and they all have their own different cycles that they go through.
So how much time do people spend, I suppose, building that relationship with you?
Yeah, I think, again, we have new clients and we have clients that we've worked with over a number of years. I think it's quite easy to build up that relationship quickly, where the advice you're giving is of specific value, and people then come back to you because actually they came to you with an issue, but actually you gave them, sometimes it's giving them more to go away and think about than an issue they came in with. And I think that's again where they can see the value, and that I think that's where the relationship builds from there. Yeah, fairly, you can get a good rapport with clients fairly quickly, but there's not always a recurring need for especially solicitors. People will have relationships with accountants because they need them on a yearly basis. They probably have a better rapport with their accountants. I think solicitors, there is a slightly negative connotation with most people go to a solicitor when they're in trouble or at a stressful time in their lives. Whereas I think with company commercial law, it's more about that growth and development and the assistance to get people to where they want to be. So I think from our perspective, it's probably easier to build a relationship with clients in that way than it is maybe in dispute resolution, where no one wants to have a dispute more than once in your lifetime if you can avoid it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I see is that quite often companies can be a little bit hesitant about committing the funds. They think, oh God, if I'm going to talk to a lawyer, it's going to get really expensive, and I don't know if I'm going to get value from that relationship. Is that something that you encounter a lot? Is that something you have to help people get past?
I think there's been a shift, and probably not so much necessarily in my career, but having spoken to a sort of my colleagues who've obviously been in practicing for a number of years.
Are you saying that your colleagues are actually quite old and that you're young blood coming in to refresh the firm?
Would I say that? But people who have probably been through, been round the block then, as it were. I think there is more of an emphasis on cost now, and people are more conscious of costs. Whereas before you would have a solicitor, an accountant. I think people do jump between professional advisors a little bit more than they probably used to. And I think a lot of that is cost-based. It's not necessarily based upon the quality of the advice. It's based upon actually they can do it slightly cheaper. And that's not always the way to probably, it's like anything in life, it's not always the best way to judge that professional advice. But no, I think there's probably an emphasis on costs now, but we all do as much as we can to reduce costs as much as we can.
Yeah.
And just actually making that process smooth. I think that's what people really want. If you're going to pay for advice, you want it to make your life easier, not to make your life harder. And yeah. I think that, yeah, you're right. There is a hesitancy to think that, yeah, negative connotation, solicitor, cost, time. Am I really going to achieve what I want to achieve?
Yeah.
Which hopefully we don't have that end result.
But. Okay. Well, look, I wanted to ask that a lot of businesses in the digital, creative and tech sector are founded by people who've got amazing ideas or a really strong opinion in how they think things should be run. But there aren't that many people who come from a business school. So given that scenario, what's your first thought when you meet a company like this for the first time? I mean, how big is your sense of dread that they might have done something fundamentally catastrophic business-wise already?
There's obviously always a chance. There's a chance if you're the most clued up businessman in the world that you've done something. I think, again, there are a lot of people who will look at, again, it's an end result. It's a driver towards, I know exactly where I'm going. But everything in between, potentially, they don't do the right way. And I don't necessarily think that is unique to a specific sort of person. I think it can happen wherever. But I think there is, yeah, in certain you get people who are really, really good at business and not necessarily great at delivering the product or the service that they are delivering. And you also get people who are really, really good with the hands-on, you know, if it's a product, they're really good with production, they're really good with all of that sort of stuff, but the business sense maybe isn't there. But I think that's where your professional advisors, and not just solicitors, accountants, tax advisors, everybody should be able to, as if you've got a decent set of advisors around you, I think that's, No one person can do everything themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably something we come across, especially with smaller companies, businesses, startups, is it's your baby at the beginning and it's your business. And when cash flow's tight, you try to do everything yourself. When you get to a certain size, it's not always possible for you to spread yourself that thinly. And it's letting go and trusting other people, be it professional advisors, employees is a big one. Mm. Is when do I take on employees? Who do I take on? And can I trust that person to deliver the service or the goods in exactly the same way or the way that I want them to? I think that's probably the biggest challenge for a lot of startups is.
So when companies get to that stage and they've come to talk to you, is there a particular thing that people have admitted to do that you see most often? You talked about employees. Is it maybe the contracts aren't that tight? Or
I think one, there's so focusing on employees initially, it's contracts, it's things like staff handbooks, it's thinking about pensions. There's obviously a lot of law and regulation around employment and employment rights, and you find people who have taken a one-page contract or actually no contract, they've just employed someone, and they should have really taken steps initially to put that documentation in place. Again, I think that's cost driven. It's a thought of, actually, I could probably save on some cost now by doing it myself. And sometimes, unfortunately, that leads to greater costs further down the line and actually putting in place what you need to put in place or rectifying a problem. Another thing that I think people don't necessarily think about is everybody goes into business, presumably to make money and be paid. Contractual relationships are a big one. Terms and conditions, downloading something off the internet, it's not a one size fits all. How you operate your business is not necessarily how someone else operates theirs.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. And what's the impact of the freely available templates on the internet? Is that, can they lead to more problems than they solve?
Definitely, because it's a case of, one size does not fit all. And how you deal with your order process, how you deal with when the contract comes into place, is it a recurring contract? Is it a one-off contract? One set of terms and conditions will not cover you for all of those things. And everybody has different business models, and you need to adapt those for your specific business. And payment terms are a big one. Is, okay, well, I issue you with an invoice and you pay it within 14 days. But what happens if they don't pay within 14 days? Your enforceability then, in terms of, do you want default interest? Do you want to be able to cease to provide the services? If it's an ongoing contract, you may say, actually, I'm going to put your account on stop. You need to really address all of those things in those terms and conditions, but not every business will operate in that way. So templates are great as a starting point, but you really just need to focus on, actually, what am I doing?
Mm. Well, while you mentioned, I mean, that's a really big point, isn't it? Cash flow is kind of critical for everybody, and late payment is a scourge for a lot of people, obviously. So, and the thing is, even if you get those conditions in place and the contract is right, how do you go about enforcing that? Because a lot of people feel like they don't have the money to be able to enforce that in the first place.
No, and I think actually having those terms, conditions, those contracts in place make it easier. So personally, I don't deal with enforcement, but my colleagues in sort of debt recovery, if they've got a decent set of terms, conditions or a contract, it's having a piece of paper to wave at someone and say, actually, this is what you've signed up to and this is what you're in breach of. And actually, things like the default interest, actually, this is the consequence of you not having paid on time. It's having the consequences that usually then it doesn't require as much input from a legal perspective or an operational perspective. Now, a lot of people will deal with debt recovery in-house. Being able to actually point to provisions within your agreement that have knock-on effects for your customer or client is a big win in terms of actually getting them to pay. If you've not really got much in terms of a stick to beat them with, then there's no real incentive for them to pay on time and they'll continue to flout your credit terms. So it's definitely making sure you've got that in place.
I mean, that's really interesting that you've got your own debt recovery team in-house.
Okay. Yeah.
So I think that some of the companies who we work with would be, well, there are two things really that they would be worried about. One is that they're going to spoil the relationship with the client that they have. And if they start demanding being paid on time, that they may not get any more work from them. That obviously leads to a question of, well, do you want more work from them if people aren't going to pay and they're going to stretch? Are they actually going to be a distraction from you running your own business? And I think the other thing is a lot of those companies wouldn't, I suppose they would hesitate before coming to a lawyer because they want to try and sort it out amicably if they can. But I suppose if there's a very professional service in place, and maybe if they've got the relationship with you sooner, that they feel that it's all been set up in a very professional basis to begin with. But those are all things which the fear is, we're quite a young company, all of this is going to cost money, is it going to be worth it? And in a way, it only becomes worth it if it all goes wrong.
But I think the problem is putting these things in place when it has gone wrong is too late. And it's true of a lot of things that we see is we are last to the party. And in a lot of cases is people come, and I think come back to your question earlier on, people come to us with problems rather than, sometimes this is what I'm looking to do in terms of, I'm a startup, I need a set of terms and conditions, I'm concerned about X, Y, and Z. If you address that early on, you're then not going to your solicitor with a problem that they have to try and rectify. You've got a problem that actually is within their skill set to actually enforce those payment terms or deal with it in the way that they and you actually initially envisaged. I think also in terms of things like debt recovery and getting paid, it's important, and there's a certain commerciality to it as well, in terms of, like you said, you don't want to scare your customers or clients off. If you're a startup and it's your first customer, the last thing you want to do is upset them. So it is having that commercial, are we a last resort? We're probably not a last resort because we don't go all guns blazing on a debt recovery. It's not the way that we would try and play things, but there is also a commerciality to it in just having a conversation. and understanding, because actually there may be a reason why they're not paying you on time. Mm. It's not just actually my credit terms are 14 days, 30 days, whatever it may be. They haven't paid. Oh, well, let's enforce against them. It's sometimes actually just finding out why they're not paying.
So is that the approach that you would take? Would somebody pick up the phone first rather than just sending kind of a final demand letter through?
Yeah, I think opening communication with a debtor is key. Is that understanding. There's obviously a formal basis upon which we have to go through things from our own regulatory perspectives. And especially if people are instructed by other firms of solicitors and it becomes a contentious debt recovery, then there's obviously a slightly more rigorous process you have to go through. But I think ultimately, if you can go about it in a fairly relaxed way, that actually leads to a better outcome for everybody, really. It means that we don't have to spend as much time chasing a debt. It means that the debtor knows where they stand, and actually our client knows exactly what the situation is. And it's understanding, is there a problem there that means that they're likely to default on all payments? And again, it comes back to, do you actually want their work and do you want them as a continuing client? Or actually, is it a one-off, they're struggling with a specific aspect, and you can then address that? It's understanding, I think, more than just, you know, it's not black and white, they haven't paid, let's do something.
So the way you're painting that kind of makes it sound like actually the legal aspect is more of an insurance policy than, is that in terms of if you set this all up right to begin with, then you're not going to have the problems, and that rephrases the issue. So you need to be seen as a step to take up front, which is going to prevent you from having problems later. The chance are you aren't going to have problems later, in the same way that your house is probably not going to burn down, but you're still going to take the insurance out just in case.
Exactly. I think that's a good way of looking at it, and a good way of dressing up is actually it is that last resort. It's if you have that commercial conversation and if you are still unable to get to a point where the debtor pays or whatever you're looking to enforce, actually you've got that formal recourse then. Whereas if you don't have that, you've completely lost your leverage. And I think that's a big thing.
Yeah. And then from a commercial point of view, from the legal firm, do you think there's a possibility? I mean, how do you price that? So let's kind of take the insurance analogy, you're paying a regular premium kind of no matter what happens, and then you get a claim. But is there any way that a legal firm would think, okay, well, let's try and even this out. Let's not have a big cost up front because we're getting all the contracts together and there are all those initial fees. But why don't we instead say, well, why don't we do like a 3-year contract and see how more we could spread that more widely? And the chances are we don't do very much in year three, but the cost would be split. Have you seen anything like that happen?
Not really. I think the way that the legal profession works mainly is on a matter by matter basis. And I think that comes down to our regulation as well, to a certain degree. We've got to be quite a transparent profession in terms of our regulator. We've got to send certain information at the beginning. We've got to give fee estimates. And I think it's difficult to do that over an extended period of time, which is why it comes down to really a matter by matter. This is what I'm looking to put in place. That's what you're instructing me to do. And this is how much I think it will cost. Yeah. But ultimately we aim to be as transparent as we can. But I think that there are, and I've seen it with especially some of the larger firms and city firms, they are bringing out product packages then for startups that include, that are a fee, that include certain documentation. Now, question marks as to how tailored that is to specific clients. I think, again, it comes back to that whole, you've got template documentation. It's not a one size fits all, but it's a very, very good starting point. I think to really get the most out of your advisor, you really need to sit with them and actually go through what you are doing on an in-depth basis, because that's the only way that you can really tailor it to exactly what you are doing. But there may well be a move in the profession to offer something a little bit more like that. There's certainly appetite, I think, amongst startups and people who have maybe cash flow restrictions for something along those lines. Legal profession is always fairly slow to react to these things.
Okay.
But it's definitely something we've seen come through a little bit more recently.
So we're going into quite a lot of depth in a particular area, which is probably kind of more than I've sort of expected, but it's really interesting kind of trying to, because actually these things really matter to some of the people. But so just to kind of redress the balance a little bit. Mm-hmm. So you've talked about the consultancy side that you're involved with, and that sort of, it's not just all about the legal, there's the kind of the whole support side. And obviously consultancy is strongly based on good relationships. And so, I think we should have a little explore about Sean Guppy, the consultant,
okay,
as well as Sean Guppy, what I know about the law.
Okay.
So I think that's some very important questions that I've got up here. And we'll kind of jump around a little bit, okay?
Okay.
So question one, do lawyers watch TV shows about other lawyers?
Yes. And they're very frustrating.
Okay.
They're very frustrating.
Very frustrating. All right. So I need a top three shows and why. If you want, I'll give
as
you
in
one
top,
to ten.
Top three as in top three about lawyers.
Top three that you like about law. Yeah. I mean, I can give you some clues if you like.
Go on then. You give
okay,
me,
give me a one to ten, The Good Wife.
See, I'm not a big fan of The Good Wife.
Not... Oh. There's going to be some very disappointed people here.
Terrible,
that.
Okay. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Terrible.
Why is that? What disappoints you about The Good Wife? Is it the acting?
You don't ever like to say it, do you? Yeah. You don't ever like to say it. I think I just don't. I think the problem is everything is over dramatized in every single way in any sort of legal. Well, it's a drama, isn't it? Ultimately, it's entertaining.
Yeah.
It's got to be entertaining. I think. It's like anything. When you look at something from having an in-depth knowledge of a particular thing, you look at it as don't quite. I'm stumbling.
Okay, well, look,
we'll do it.
The important thing to know is do you have a kick-ass researcher like Kalinda who can go in and sort stuff out for you like that in a moment, in a heartbeat?
Unfortunately not. That would be good. That would be great, wouldn't it?
That would be great, wouldn't it? Somebody who can just come and sort it all out and kind of hack into any system that they like.
That would be pretty cool.
Okay. Let's try another one. Suits.
Suits. So Suits, again, American, it's Americanized, which is fine, which is brilliant. But I don't know how one legal practitioner knows so much about family law, commercial law. I just don't know. He's fantastic.
Yeah.
Harvey Specter is amazing.
Yeah.
But I don't know how he gets to the point that he gets to. He's an interesting character.
Do the legal team at Steel Raymond have the ability to be able to look at a contract in 2 seconds and be able to digest everything on that page?
Obviously. Of course.
Okay. I thought that was good. Okay. And then Good Wife or Suits, which would you
rather? I would rather watch Suits.
Rather watch Suits.
I would rather watch Suits. Yeah, I think it's a little bit more. I think it's a little bit more accurate.
Okay.
I know I've just slated them for how broad their legal knowledge
is.
That's
accurate. Oh, wow.
I think it's a little bit more reflective, probably especially of city lawyers, long hours, all of that sort of stuff.
Okay.
So,
it's hard work, isn't it?
Definitely.
But what, okay, well then, absolute classic, Better Call Saul.
we're now straying into completely different areas now, aren't we? Better Call Saul.
Is that your life experience as a lawyer? Have
Definitely.
You ever got anywhere near that?
But like the car that doesn't quite start every
yeah,
morning,
the,
and
the mug. The mug's
the
great.
The mug's great. I haven't got my face on a billboard yet.
Okay,
I need to do that at some point. We can try and do that. I don't know whether the marketing budget will stretch to that.
Okay.
I'm getting a nod.
Yeah.
So
okay.
We can go for something along those lines.
Excellent. But, all right. Okay. So let's come back. Take a step back. So the road to success, it's fraught with potential legal dangers. And I thought, why don't we have a look at this from the perspective of, for want of a better expression, the perspective of a spectacular failure, opportunities, and work our way backwards. So the holy grail of most companies is to sell or go public. For a vast sum, so the founders and the long-term workers retire, buy a yacht, and live the dream, which, unfortunately, much to their and everyone else's surprise, often means drinking too much and becoming very bored and possibly boring. So that aside, now I know you don't deal with people like that because you're a reputable firm with good people. Of course not. So without betraying anyone's confidence, can you tell me some of the big issues that you've come across when you get to this stage?
In terms of sales
of
processes.
Of the big sell. When you get to that point, sort of, it's time to sell the company?
Yeah. So we had one where we had a lot of supercars within a company that we had to extract. That was an interesting transaction. But I think it's...
You had to extract them. What's that?
Extract. So they were personal cars that were purchased through the company. Okay. So there's a purchasing process, an exit where essentially the sellers wanted to retain their cars,
okay.
extracting those from the company in obviously a tax efficient way, but yep. in a way that is not just extracting them for the sake of extracting them. So that was quite an interesting okay. transaction.
Assuming that's not a car dealership and they
were it was not. No, okay. no, it wasn't. But issues that we come across more than anything is probably documentation, really. And actually, there's a process you can get through. You rarely get to a point where it happens on occasion. Someone picks up the phone, catches you off guard and makes you an offer. And we've had that happen. And it does happen for some companies. But a lot of people will be gearing up. They will have in their sights an exit at some point. And it's certainly worthwhile at that point sort of stepping back and taking stock and having a look. Actually, most people will consult accountants. Most people will have corporate finance advisors. But actually, lawyers at that point can have a very big part to play in terms of actually almost doing a dummy due diligence exercise mm-hmm. in, you know, this is a standard set of inquiries we would see. And you can then identify, playing devil's advocate, actually, okay, the information you've given me, this is what I don't think you have in place at the moment. This is what doesn't work. This is what does work. This is what mm-hmm. you do really, really well. And we should emphasize in a due diligence process. But it does highlight the gaps and it means you can address those before you get to a sales process. Once you're there, it's slightly too late, and it means that a buyer is going to want increased sort of warranty and indemnity protection, and you're actually not going to have the clean break potentially you wanted from the company.
Have you come across, I suppose, the most common things that when you get to that position, people will be going, why didn't I do this 5 years ago?
I think the most common thing actually at the moment is data protection.
Okay.
And everybody's heard GDPR last year, everybody probably went nuts with GDPR. And I think there was a statement issued by the Information Commissioner's Office that they were going to be fairly relaxed about GDPR compliance in the first instance. So I think as a firm gearing up for GDPR coming into place, we had October, November time, we had a few inquiries. And as it got closer and closer, people were getting more and more fraught and we were getting more inquiries come through. There are certain people who haven't done any sort of GDPR preparation and don't have any data protection policies. And I think given the extensive fines that you can now get, that's something that a lot of sales and buy teams rather are actually focusing on. So we've seen that a lot recently.
And do you think in terms of trying to resolve that, that's something you come and talk to a lawyer about, or is that something that you talk to specialist GDPR agents about?
Either. I think it's just important. Take the advice.
Yeah.
Lawyers are probably best placed in terms of the actual regulations and the law in terms of actually those policies that you need. There are some specialist GDPR agencies and people out there who can give you that support. But I think the important thing is talk to someone about it. Don't just ignore it. Don't bury your head in the sand, because at some point, whether it's a sales process or not, something with relating to personal data could come back and bite you. And I think, again, at that point, it's too late to put it right for that specific issue.
Yeah.
So it's addressing it as early as you possibly can.
What about share ownership and sort of early kind of when equity's been divided, people kind of set up years before and it's like, oh, we're liberally sprinkling shares all over the place, and you know, or maybe somebody owns all of them, or there's a 50-50 split that can often go horribly wrong, I think. Yeah. Just thoughts around that.
Share ownership's an interesting one, and specifically around statutory books and registers. So that's a set of books essentially that records who your shareholders are. So allotments, transfers of shares, who they are at the moment. A lot of companies don't know where they are, historically maintained by solicitors and accountants, but where people potentially shift between professional advisors now, they don't necessarily take those books with them. So we find ourselves trying to reconstitute a lot of statutory books from companies' house records. Share buybacks are another point where we have, that comes up quite a lot on sale transactions specifically. If you don't do a share buyback, so a share buyback is essentially where a company purchases its own shares out of its profits, where you don't do that fully in compliance with the Companies Act, it's a void transaction. And we do sometimes have scenarios whereby you've had a shareholder 10 years ago, did a company share buyback, it was a void buyback. Technically, that individual still holds those shares. It's sod's law that you no longer get on with that person or know where that person is. And it's therefore very, very difficult to rectify that at that point. So yeah, again, understanding who your shareholders are and subscriber shares. So when you initially incorporate a company, it is incorporated with a subscriber share, 100 subscriber shares. where it's usually incorporated with one subscriber share. We see it fairly commonly that that subscriber share has somehow gone missing in terms of it's not been taken forward in the share numbers.
What is a subscriber share?
So it's when you apply to register a company at Companies House, you have to have at least one director and one shareholder. So most people will incorporate a company with one shareholder holding a single share. That is your subscriber share. And then you allot further shares out of that. But people sometimes forget that they had that one subscriber share. It's forgotten about. It was part of the incorporation process. It doesn't really matter. Let's allot another 100 shares. And then moving forwards, they record that they've only got 100 shares in issue, when in fact they've got 101, which is fine where you've had someone who has owned the company all the way through. There's no risk there. But where the company changes hands or you've had a lot of share transfers, that can be problematic, and a buyer can certainly be unnerved where they can't track through who the shareholders are. Ultimately, they want 100% of the shares. And even if there's one rogue share that's out there, doesn't always bode well for a seller.
And do you sometimes deal where a company's got a 50-50% split? Because, I mean, sometimes half the person, you know, one person wants to sell, the other person doesn't want to sell. Kind of, how do you start kind of smoothing out the waters in situations like that?
So that's a difficult one. And again, it's nobody goes into business with, you don't get married to get divorced. You don't go into a 50-50 to fall out with the other person. But unfortunately, it does happen. And people have different business ideas and different ways of running businesses. So it's not something we see very, very often, but it does happen. But I think when you go into anything like that, you've got to think about the potential issues that you may face in the future. And that can all be covered off in legal documentation through a shareholders agreement or a partnership agreement if you've not got a limited company. And that just regulates the relationship between those parties and usually will provide some sort of dispute resolution mechanism, which can have a number of end results. It can say exactly what you want it to say, but ultimately it will usually entail a number of options for one party to buy the other out. Or actually, if you can't get to a point where either of you wants to buy the other out, it's then a forced sale of the company, and then neither party really has much choice at that stage. So it's carving through that issue early doors. And
one of the things that I've heard advised is get somebody else involved, just give somebody else a percent. So there's not 50-50 split ever. Somebody can always make a casting vote.
Yeah, so again, there's obviously two levels that you've got: director level and you've got shareholder level. Director level is a majority of the directors, so that can help sometimes. If you only have two directors, a 50-50 shareholder, you've got each of those as a director. Bring in someone who is slightly impartial and can actually give you, like a non-exec or someone who can actually give you some advice to help you unbreak those deadlocks if they arise. Shareholder level is slightly different in terms of, I suppose, who do you take that 1% away from in terms of that 50-50 split? The better way to deal with it is probably in a shareholders agreement where you actually, you retain the ownership of your shares. You're not then giving away any sort of decision-making power to someone else, but actually your relationship as a partnership or a 50-50 shareholding is fully regulated, and you and everybody knows from day one actually what's expected of them.
Okay. Well, look, so I've got so many questions I want to ask you, but there's only so much that we can, you know, dissect the law in one session, and we haven't got a huge amount of time. So I'm going to come back and try a few quick-fire questions.
Okay,
quick-fire questions. NDAs, are they worth the paper they're written on? They're
worthwhile having, definitely. Depends what you're using them for. But yes, I would definitely get it. It depends on the information you're sharing, but yes, they are worth the paper they're written on. They give you that protection. It's an insurance policy. It puts obligations on people to not disclose the information that you are giving to them. So yeah, 100% I would recommend NDAs in certain circumstances.
What about when people you really want to get advice from refuse to sign them? Like most entrepreneurs who give advice or mentoring, they won't sign them because they'd just be bombarded with them.
It's from
a startup idea.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting one, that, because if you're not going to use or look to profit from the information that someone else is going to give you, I think from a legal perspective, we probably struggle with reasons as to why you wouldn't necessarily sign one. I appreciate it may be an administrative burden, but actually if that is the realm in which you are operating and the services you are providing, I would say that actually I think it's a core part, it's protection for your client. And if your client feels that they need that, then there doesn't seem to be any reason why you wouldn't necessarily sign that.
I think the flip side is that quite often the idea is seldom as unique as the person having it thinks it is, and you've already seen something like that before. So what position are you left in if you've suddenly signed an NDA? You can't talk about something, but actually that idea is already in the public domain.
But if it's something that's in the public domain, then it's not confidential information that could be protected by an NDA in any event. So I think then...
Well, it may not be in the public domain, but it would be kind of in your domain at least, because if you work with a lot of startups, the chances are two people are going to have a similar idea.
Yeah, no, I can see that point. I think it's then actually scoping that NDA in a specific way. It's to ensure that actually... The client that you are dealing with, you've got a rough idea of what their idea may be. It's actually scoping it to protect the unique elements of that idea rather than just generic information that you may have come across before.
Okay. So now the quick fire question.
Yes.
Copyright. Can you send yourself an idea in a sealed envelope and post it? And does that mean a thing?
Copyright's an intro. Again, a very, very intellectual property law is just a minefield of sort of regulation and laws, really. Copyright's an interesting one. It arises as soon as you come up with a creative idea, as soon as you put pen to paper, as soon as you draw something, the copyright rests with you. Now, if you are looking to pursue someone for a copyright infringement, it will be based on evidence. And evidence, as silly as it sounds, things like that, anything that's date stamped, anything that's proof as to when the idea was created and who created it, it can't hurt. It will add to your defense or actually to an action that you're bringing. So
okay, that makes sense. Okay,
yeah. Yep. So if you write a song, sing it in a mirror, record it. You look like a singer, Anthony. You look like a singer.
I'm singing in the mirror all the
time.
There
we go. Yeah. But no. Yeah. But then it shows. It shows actually it was your creation. It was your and date stamp and time stamp and anything like that is really, really useful when it comes to some sort of copyright infringement.
Well, seeing as you brought up singing in the mirror. Yes. Solicitors, lawyers, do they practice, whether they're barristers or not, do they practice closing speeches in their own bedrooms as if they were talking to a judge in the way that an actor will always practice their Oscar acceptance speech just in case?
So I haven't personally, but I probably know some people who have. So yeah, no, not something I've personally done, but I'm sure there are bound to be some people out there.
I think it's just a question of time.
Yes, yeah, we'll get there eventually.
If only just to help kind of the thoughts come through.
When I get that billboard, okay. I might start I might start practicing the mirror.
Signing a contract when drunk, can you get out of it?
Signing. Good question. Prove that you were drunk at the time.
Because that could be a real problem for all those people who are signing contracts in Cannes and MIP and kind of those TV and film festivals late at night.
Again, it's one that I don't think there's an easy answer for that. Okay. I don't think there's an easy answer, but you can sign one if you're drunk. You just got to try and run a decent defence to it.
Okay. Signing a contract under duress. What is duress? How do you prove duress? Is duress just because somebody told you, mate, or do you have to be actually strapped to a chair with a gun in your head?
Doesn't need to be any tape involved or anything like that. It is, I think duress is basically being under pressure to do something. So be that physical pressure, mental pressure, or just the, you know, not having something explained to you correctly. I think this is where it's important to seek advice where you don't understand things, because duress arguments are not the easiest to run in terms of actually, again, it comes down to a proof point. And how can anybody prove that they were under duress? Again, it comes back to how can you prove that they weren't? And this is where, especially with legal documents, we'll get independent legal advice. We'll send people off to actually get explained to them by someone who is completely independent. That overcomes duress points. But it's a very, very difficult thing to get out of. So if it's something you don't understand, don't sign it, is the message.
So back to Sean Guppy, the consultant.
Yes.
Do you have any dogs?
No, I have two cats. I have two cats.
Are you married?
I am indeed, yes.
Excellent. And as a solicitor, did you make your wife sign a prenup agreement just because you could?
My wife is also a solicitor.
Did she make you sign one?
No, she didn't actually. No, I don't think... No, we didn't go down that route.
Okay.
We didn't.
That's romantic. That's nice.
Yeah, there we go. Trust.
Okay. I just wondered, you know, if there was like, it's because you could. It's like, not that you wanted one, but going, hey, I've got a firm of solicitors. I might as well use them.
Here we go. We've got nothing to protect, but let's sign them anyway.
Okay. So then, and just lastly, because we're kind of running out of time. So you came to Bournemouth through university, is that right?
I did indeed, yes. So okay. I grew up in Yeovil for 18 years. Obviously, I can't tell you why I wanted to become a solicitor, but as far back as I remember, that's what I wanted to do. Quite a focused mind in terms of where I wanted to end up. I haven't got any family in law. Law, again, cynically, is not always necessarily what you know. Sometimes it is who you know. It's having those connections. I think that's true in a lot of walks of life. So I ended up in Bournemouth because Bournemouth University was one of the only universities in the UK at that point to offer a placement year as part of their LLB course. I like Bournemouth as a place. So I did my placement at Steel Raymond, got my training contract off the back of that. So it shows that that whole placement scheme does work. And I've stuck around ever since.
Were you tempted to leave elsewhere, or did the lure of the beach keep you down here?
I think when everybody goes into, not necessarily everybody, when you go into a law degree and you think you may want to be a solicitor or a barrister and you haven't decided quite where you want to end up, I think London is where everybody expects you to go. And I think there's a certain draw when you're younger that may be actually where you want to end up.
I think that's probably why you like suits more than you like the Good Wife.
There we go, exactly. Yeah,
you want that busy kind of like, yes, I'm here in the corporate law world.
Definitely. I think work-life balance in Bournemouth is obviously slightly better than it is in a London solicitor's firm. We haven't got sleeping pods in our office. We haven't got hairdressers. We haven't got gyms. So it's nice when you've got a nice summer's evening and you can get out and have a walk by the beach and go home and see your cats or do whatever you want to do. But I think once I'd secured my training contract in Bournemouth, I knew that Steel Raymond, and off the back of my placement, I knew that Steel Raymond was where I wanted to be, definitely in the short term. And I've been back there now for a good 5 years, and I love it as a firm. It's got a fantastic reputation locally. So no, I haven't got any desires to go anywhere at the moment, but we'll see. Never say never, but no, I'm enjoying Bournemouth and I'm enjoying everything that Steel Raymond has to offer me as well.
Sean, thank you so much. Thank you for putting up with my very rude questions. Really interesting to talk to you. I really like hearing the way that your mind thinks through some of the problems as well. And it's going, I'm really glad that you're a solicitor and not me, because my mind doesn't work in that same way. So that's really good.
We're all good at different things, aren't we? And I think that's what makes us unique.
Thank you so much. It's been really good to chat with you.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. There's more information about all of our guests and all the topics they talk about at 10thdegree.co.uk. And also, please do review us. We really want to share the lessons and the advice that's given as widely as possible, and this really helps us to get that message out there. Thanks.